Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and culture stories. I am Netta Ulibi. You can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, NPR's Arts Channel has for you a new documentary on the complex life and contentious death of U.S. Army Ranger Pat Tillman. Former Beach Boy Brian Wilson channels the spirit of George Gershwin in his new album. And we profile the Soul Queen of New Orleans, Irma Thomas, as part of our 50 Great Voices series. But first,
our colleague Scott Simon remembers the moment that he and his wife decided to adopt. Scott and Caroline Simon traveled twice to China to bring back children. In his new book, Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, the Saturday host of NPR's Weekend Edition says they decided to adopt after struggling to conceive.
We'd both been around the world. We'd both seen different places. We had we'd both been in places where there are a lot of children who'd been abandoned, and we just looked at each other and said, why are we doing this? There are children in the world now who need our love, and we sure need them.
This really is an emotional choice that you make. If you made a rational, if you had a rational thought process about it, if you tried to consider it as a business decision, you wouldn't really do it. It's something that you do because you want to do it.
It is an emotional choice, and for some people, adoption is just something that will that they think will never work with them, and so they decide not to do it. All of that being said, I would like to open that door for people. It is difficult, time-consuming, and expensive to adopt a child in this country. Whether you adopt internationally, as my wife and I did, whether you adopt domestically, may I say, as your family did, as your parents did.
My parents did, yes.
And because of that, for a lot of people, the assisted fertility industry is just an obvious alternative to that. That being said, look, the instinct to adopt, to take children into our lives is, I think, practically as old as childbirth.
How much did you think about the fact in advance that the baby you were going to adopt from China was going to be a Chinese baby?
You know, we knew it, but I can't say we thought about it much. And we certainly didn't think about it much. We went to China to get both of our little girls. We want to travel back to China every few years so they can get a chance to see the country up close as they grow up. But all of that being said, it's a feature of their personality. It's, I think, not the defining trait of our relationship.
You write that somebody asked your wife, do you feel guilty for taking your daughters away from their native culture?
Yeah. A very learned woman who we like a lot, who's a friend of the family. And my wife just answered, no, not really. I think I would have had a tougher time holding my tongue. And that's because when we talk about ethnicity, we say Chinese. To someone who's Chinese, that's not necessarily their ethnicity. There are almost 100 ethnicities that are living in China. So in a sense, we don't really know their ethnicity. So we shouldn't get, I think, too preoccupied with it. One of my favorite vignettes that I have in the book is about Martin Simon, who was the son of the late Paul Simon, senator from Illinois, no relation to me, alas, and Gene Simon, who grew up with, it appeared on his birth certificate that he was Native American. And he grew up, his father was an influential member of the Senate Subcommittee on Native American Affairs.
Deliberately so, right? Because he's like, oh, I've got an adopted son.
People, his high school friends would look at him and say, you know, Martin, he's part Cherokee. And people would say, yeah, you can tell when you look at him. And you might see where this story is going. Years later, he's 28 years old. He meets his birth mother, who's only 15 years older than him. They're talking and reaching out to each other and enjoying getting to know each other. But as he said to me, she looked just about as Native American as Diana, Princess of Wales. And he finally said to her, how are we Indian? And she said, Indian? He said, yes, in my birth certificate, it says Native American. And she said, oh, they asked me what we were, and I said, we're all American. And as he said, you know, I spent all that time going to powwows. I mean, he felt Native American. He didn't feel Scandinavian, which turns out to be his ethnic heritage. But I think the point of that, firstly, is the power of suggestion. He said all of those years, nobody ever looked at him and said, come on, now, you're not American Indian. And I think it's also an instruction to us to not invest too much of our identity in ethnicity.
Your kids must be getting to that age, if they haven't practically always been in it, when they start asking you awkward questions about everything. What are some of the hardest questions you've heard from your kids?
The hardest question I've heard is from our 7-year-old daughter, Elise, who says, why did my mother give me up? And that's a rough one.
I'm sorry. You know, I get this way when I talk about my children.
It's okay.
That's a rough one because she's old enough to understand that she was given up by a woman who, when we tell her your mother loved you and she wanted to take care of you for the rest of your life and she wanted to be a mother to you, but she just couldn't. Yet it's hard, I think, for a 7-year-old to understand. How do you explain China's one-child policy? How do you explain
the bias toward that one child being a boy rather than a girl?
Yeah, how do you really explain that? She also, you know, children tend not to be metaphorical the way we are. They're literal. So she asks, because we've told her the story that we know, that she was left in front of a light bulb factory. And she says, she asks, was I cold?
Oh.
And, we say, no, you weren't. Your mother wrapped you up before she put you there on the sidewalk. Pretty confident that you'd be discovered by someone who would help you. So she wrapped you up. But, you know, I think to a degree I really respect in both of our youngsters, and it's audible now with Elise, they're comfortable with being adopted. There is no way that we're going to be able to spare them the sting and the hurt of feeling that at some point there was someone who gave them up. No matter how many times we explained your mother loved you, no matter how many times we explained that we're grateful for the courage your mother had to even bear you in China, I don't think we can spare her the hurt. But, you know, we learn from hurts in life, don't we? You know, we put something over them and we keep on going. And I think our two daughters are going to be very strong, in part because of that. I don't think they're going to be broken by that.
Scott Simon's latest book is called Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other. Scott, thanks.
Thank you.
When pro football star turned Army Ranger Pat Tillman was killed in Afghanistan in 2004, he was hailed by the Bush administration as a hero who died in combat. But it didn't take long for a more complicated story to emerge after Tillman's family challenged the Army's version of events. Bob Mondello says a new documentary, The Tillman Story, chronicles the uncovering of a cover-up.
A few months after the World Trade Center bombings in 2001, all-star defensive back Pat Tillman walked away from a multi-million dollar contract with the Arizona Cardinals to enlist in the Army. He was perhaps the most famous enlisted man in the armed services, lionized when news came 2 years later that he'd been killed in an ambush by the Taliban. His actions, said military sources, saved his comrades. The media drumbeat was insistent and heroic.
Tillman ordered his men up a hill to attack terrorists that had pinned down part of his platoon.
Tillman's voice was heard issuing commands to take the fight to the enemy forces.
None of this was true. Tillman died by friendly fire, and at least one of his fellow soldiers says there were no enemy forces present. Tillman's family said they learned weeks later that the inspiring story the military had circulated was a fabrication, based on reports the government knew to be false. The film shows a paper trail that seems to trace that knowledge of falsehood high into the Bush administration.
General Stanley McChrystal had sent the P-4 memo on April 29th. After White House speechwriters had requested details about Pat's death from the Pentagon.
That memo, says Tillman's mother, is evidence that the government knew early on what the family discovered later, that the official story was a lie.
The P-4 memo states they must warn the president about this because they'll be giving speeches and that they shouldn't be embarrassed if the circumstances of Pat's death become public.
The warning seemed to work. In a speech given 2 days before the memorial service, the president avoided the very details of Pat's death that his speechwriters had requested.
Meanwhile, Tillman's wife, Marie, was resisting pressure to turn the family's private funeral into an occasion for patriotic grandstanding and full military honors.
During basic training, Pat had a premonition that if he died, he might be used as a public relations stunt. so he'd smuggled a copy of his final wishes home to Marie.
I really had to kind of push back on them. They were just sort of proceeding as if this was the way things were going to happen. Probably thinking that, you know, I was so grief-stricken that I would just go along with it.
Director Amir Bar-Lev finds a riveting detective story here, how the family forced an army investigation and then forced Congress to investigate that investigation, each time with additional embarrassing admissions from public officials. The Tillman story is ferocious filmmaking, but wouldn't have half the force it does if the director didn't also get at the complicated man Pat Tillman was, the football star who volunteered to serve in a war he later doubted the logic for, the avowed atheist who read the Book of Mormon. As you get a sense of Tillman the man, you better understand his family's fury at the flag-waving being done in his name. And when the director finally takes his camera to the rocky, barren valley where Tillman died and recreates how the military now says that happened, all hope of clarity evaporates. The notion of an accidental shooting in battle conjures images of murky sight lines, stray shots coming out of nowhere. But when you see the actual terrain, where Tillman was standing, where his comrades were, hard to say how the tragedy happened, but harder to imagine it happening the way they say. You emerge from the Tillman story feeling a little of what the Tillman family must, that the whole truth about their son's death hasn't yet been told, and may never be. I'm Bob Mondello.
When Brian Wilson was just a little kid, maybe 3 or 4 years old, long before he found fame and fortune singing about the California surf, his parents took him to visit his grandmother.
And my grandmother put on Rhapsody in Blue for me. They had me lay down by the record player, and they played Rhapsody in Blue. And I just remember, I loved it so much, you know, I really did. The arranging, the impetus, the excitement, the beauty, it was just an absolute work of art.
6 decades later, after building the Beach Boys, then struggling with drugs and mental problems, and finally rebounding, Brian Wilson was ready to take on his icon, George Gershwin. The new album is called Brian Wilson Reimagines Gershwin. And when I talked with Wilson this week, he said that when the Gershwin estate approached him about making the record, he didn't have to be asked twice.
And as soon as I heard about that, I bit. I said, yeah, I'll do it.
It's really amazing listening to the record because your style actually meshes pretty well with these songs. At first, it seems like... I think of your melodies and the Beach Boy melodies, and I don't necessarily think of I Got Rhythm, for instance, but a song like that really works so well, and I want to play a bit of it now.
We wanted to do it give it a Beach Boy feel. So we gave it like a raka chaka, raka chaka, raka chaka, a little Deuce Coupe kind of feel. We gave it a Beach Boy flavor to it, you know.
It's more than a flavor. Were you afraid to take over Gershwin?
No. I was just in awe of him the whole time.
One interesting thing is that there are songs on the record that I heard actually were unfinished works. Explain what that means. Are those bits of paper, bits of recordings?
They gave us 104 unfinished piano songs.
Wow.
All played by George Gershwin. And then we were supposed to narrow it down to just 2 songs out of all 104. And we kept listening and listening, and the two that caught our ear was mostly the harmony and the melody. And from there, we wrote songs, originated new songs based out of the 2 we took.
And the two you chose were Nothing But Love and a song called The Like in I Love You.
The pain in painting, the music, music, the like in I love you.
What was it like trying to write in the style of another artist?
Well, it was interesting because of Gershwin. I wouldn't do this for anybody else but Gershwin, actually, you know, tell you the truth.
Really?
No, I don't think there's an artist in the world that I'd rather do this than Gershwin.
Why is that? Why do you relate to him?
Well, because he's so great. You know, he's so darn great, and his music is so uplifting, it makes you feel good. I loves you, Porgy, don't let him take me. Don't let him handle me and drive me mad.
I want to ask you about I Loves You, Porgy, which is from Porgy and Bess, and that's not a song you usually hear a guy singing. So what choices did you make when you approached doing this song?
I told you know, my wife and my orchestrator, I said, you know, this should be a girl singing this song, right? I said, would you guys mind if I sang it and assumed the role of a girl? And they said, fine. And then when the Disney people heard it, they go, Brian, you're supposed to be a girl. I said, I don't care. So I sang it a little bit sweetly, you know.
Someday I know he's coming to call me. He's gonna handle me and hold me so. It's gonna be like dying for me. But when he calls, I'll have to go.
There's one last thing. A quote from Gershwin in the liner notes to your record. He says, true music must repeat the thought and inspirations of the people and the time. My people are Americans, and my time is today. And I thought it was interesting that that was in the notes, because it's something that could have been said about your music and the Beach Boys back in the 60s.
That's right. And believe it or not, he the greater, me the lesser. I could never be as good as George, but I can emulate him and present him to the new generation.
Musician Brian Wilson, his new record is Brian Wilson Reimagines Gershwin. Brian Wilson, thank you so much.
Thank you, ma'am.
It ain't necessarily so. It ain't necessarily so. The things that you're liable to read in the...
One place where the Classics Library is alive and well is iTunes. That's where Italian composer Claudio Monteverdi is enjoying top 10 status among classical music albums with a new recording of his 1610 masterpiece, The Vespers of the Blessed Virgin. What makes this surprising is that this is an indie recording by a little-known Miami-based professional choir called Seraphic Fire. Jeff London decided to check it out.
Seraphic Fire made its debut a little over 7 years ago, but classical music critic Greg Stepanich says it's become an essential part of South Florida's music scene, performing works from the Renaissance to the 21st century.
Every concert that they do is not just sort of like, well, we're going to put some stuff on here that people will like. It's all thought out intellectually. And then when you go hear it, it's vocally brilliant.
The group's founder and conductor is Patrick Dupre Quigley. Under his leadership, Seraphic Fire has sung with the New World Symphony and...
We recorded with Shakira on her album Oral Fixation 2 and recorded sort of a Gregorian chant-esque track to open that disc.
A couple of years ago, when Seraphic Fire received a $25,000 grant, they decided to tackle a big project, recording Claudio Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610, one of the greatest choral works of all time. So they teamed up with the Western Michigan University Chorale and recorded it in a little stone chapel in Kalamazoo. Quigley says this famous piece has a kind of utilitarian history. Around 1608, the middle-aged Monteverdi was unhappy in his position with the Gonzaga family at the court in Mantua. So over the course of the next 2 years, he compiled a large book of his compositions, which included the Vespers, and dedicated it to the Pope.
The Vespers is, in essence, a job application, or at least the lore tells us.
And it worked.
Eventually, the position at St. Mark's in Venice came open, the basilica there, and he assumed the directorship there, and the rest is history.
Quigley says the piece is often performed in a grand manner with brass and strings.
Most of the recordings and most of the performances that one hears of this piece tend to be a large Baroque Renaissance in the middle there, orchestral accompaniment with double choir and soloists.
But in the score, Monteverdi suggests it can be done in a smaller way.
When we take a step back and look at the words that Monteverdi himself wrote in the print, we see that the word optional is used a whole heck of a lot.
So instead of a large orchestra, Patrick Quigley chose to use only three instrumentalists. He calls the piece revolutionary, juxtaposing large overlapping choral sections with intimate moments for soloists in what would then be considered a contemporary popular style. Like this piece, the Nigrasum.
Basically, the text is, I have been laboring in the sun, but I still hold my beauty. And it's a very sensual text. And the tenor, instead of singing in any sort of sacred style, any sort of chant-esque style, this is a vocal line which is written with this rhetorical up and down that was so popular in madrigals and theatrical music at the time.
Quigley says Monteverdi also illustrates the text in the choral parts.
There's a moment in the Dixit Dominus where it talks about this flowing water, and Monteverdi, in order to show the cascading water of this small river rushing to become a torrent, he sets each of the choral voices in three, which then overlap each other differently, and you have this feeling of undulation.
When the recording was finished, Patrick Quigley shopped it to several record labels, all of whom turned him down. Even though they liked it, they said,
we're at that point in the recording industry where we just can't afford to take a gamble on someone that we know nothing about.
So Seraphic Fire released the CD themselves and placed it on iTunes. When it came out last week, it was a featured selection. Quigley took a screenshot, put it on his Facebook page, and tagged everyone who was on the recording.
And everyone started to share this with all of their friends on Facebook and saying, look, you know, we got featured on iTunes. Well, by the end of the day, someone noticed that we had moved into the 18th best-selling classical album on iTunes.
And within 36 hours, it was number 6. Quigley says the viral explosion has been gratifying for many reasons, but most especially because so many of the people who downloaded it were unfamiliar with Claudio Monteverdi.
Introducing a younger audience to this 400-year-old music. I mean, it was one of those fantastic things that happens only through the internet.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London.
Today we're going to talk with one of the biggest names in Bollywood, the Indian film industry, which is known for idealized romance and cheerful song and dance numbers. But Aamir Khan is not here to talk about typical Bollywood fare. He's produced a much more serious film than Bollywood is known for, and in fact, he's not even in it. The film is about farmer suicides in rural India. Hundreds of thousands of farmers have killed themselves because they're unable to pay their debts. India's government actually pays compensation to their families, which is why one farmer is considering suicide in Aamir Khan's movie. It's in a mix of English and Hindi, and it's called Peepli Live, named after a made-up village called Peepli. Aamir Khan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks. Thank you.
Now, this is a very unusual film, both because it tackles a controversial issue and because it's satirical.
That's right. I mean, mainstream films in India don't usually tackle such serious topics, and satire is something that is not often picked up as a style of storytelling. And as I decided to produce it, I was aware that this is a film that is certainly doesn't fit into mainstream Indian cinema and would have a fairly niche audience back home in India. But I just loved it, so I wanted to do it.
How serious an issue is this, farmer suicide?
Well, it is a fairly serious issue. I mean, if you look just at the numbers from 91 to 2001, that's 200,000 farmers. It's like an epidemic, and it's not a one-off anymore. And so that's really a scary and heartbreaking thought.
Well, the basic story is that a very poor farmer who lives in the village of Peepli, he is pressured by his family. I mean, it would be saying too much to suggest that he thought of this himself. He doesn't seem to have very many thoughts.
Yeah, his elder brother actually kind of cons him into agreeing to commit suicide after they hear of this government program which says that any farmer committing suicide, his family gets a compensation of 100,000 rupees, which is roughly $2,000. And so his elder brother kind of gets him to agree to commit suicide, but he doesn't really want to and has no intentions of. But finds himself in this place where everyone's looking at him, you know, to do that. For example, his son asks him, "So, Dad, when are you committing suicide? Because Uncle says when you're dead, I'll become a contractor," and stuff like that. So it's actually a satiric view on all of us.
Most of the funny moments, the satirical moments, involve politicians and involve the media, but especially the media. The sort of over-the-top quality of the way the story is covered in the news media and your movie. Mm-hmm. All these trucks, they all converge on this little bitty place, Peepli.
Yes.
And then they talk to everybody in the town.
Yes.
There's a very funny sequence in which they talk to shopkeepers who are saying, "I hope that he will commit suicide. It would be very good for business."
Yeah. Yes, so each one has their own take on this, yeah. And but quite honestly, you know, I mean, the way the media is in India, I don't know whether it's that different from the rest of the world, quite frankly.
And of course, they are hoping against hope that he will commit suicide while they are filming him.
That also, and what adds to, you know, what adds to the entire thing is that there's a local election happening at that point of time, and which is why things completely spiral out of control. So, yeah, so, you know, all of this and the media, of course, in India, there's been a sudden growth of the media. And as a result, a lot of the reporting is extremely sensational and with an eye on just purely getting TRPs.
The ratings. Getting the ratings. At one point in the film, we see an editor shouting at his reporter in Hindi,
yeah,
"Why didn't we have this story? This could be a live suicide. It will turn the election. And even if it doesn't, we'll get great ratings."
Yeah.
And toward the end, the female reporter character, whose name is Nandita,
yeah,
she makes the same point. "Audiences don't care about poor people," she says. "They just want to hear more about this farmer who's threatened to commit suicide." We have a clip from the movie.
"Do you know why? Because he is the original live suicider. Do you have any idea how big this is? We're journalists, and this is what we do."
Yeah, well, this is actually reflective not only of the media, but also, you know, it's reflective on all of us as a society, and how we do, in fact, move towards stories which are sensational. I mean, when you watch it unfolding, it's the bizarreness of it really gets to you, and it's very funny as you watch it, but the sad fact is that it's actually not very far from the truth.
The film's director, Anusha Rizvi, wanted to use music that would be decidedly different from songs that Bollywood fans are used to. The subject of this song scarcely calls to mind romantic images. It's about inflation.
It wasn't in the film when the script was written. It was when she was actually in Badwai, the village that she was shooting in. She heard the local, you know, band of musicians one night singing this song. So this is a song that they had written for themselves or the villagers, and they were singing it. And she really loved it. So that's how it came about. Is, I mean, it's a song that's recorded live on location, not in a studio. And so it's a song that's composed and written by these bunch of villagers who were singing it.
And who are having the experience, presumably.
And exactly. This is their voice. This is what they have to say about inflation.
One of the lines is, my husband earns a lot of money, but inflation, that witch, eats it all away every month. Yeah. It's very funny.
It's a funny song, yeah.
For you to make a film which is essentially political, in which you satirize not only the politicians, but of course your own audience, your movie audience,
sure,
and the media.
Yes,
this is a new direction for you. Do you think this is something that you can afford to do, or that other actors will do?
Well, I don't know who else will do it, but I, you know, as an entertainer, when I come across material which excites me, which not only is engaging and entertaining, but also has something to say or hopefully sensitizes people or makes you think, I'd like to be part of that.
Thank you very, very much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Linda. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Amir Khan is the producer of a new movie called Peeply Live.
Today, a voice that makes you sit up straight. When Irma Thomas heard she was chosen as one of NPR's 50 Great Voices,
I kind of lit up like, wow, I'm among 50 Great Voices. Hey.
Sitting home alone, thinking about my past, wondering how I made it, and how long it's gonna last.
Irma Thomas is from New Orleans. She is of New Orleans.
How much of what's in your voice do you think is from New Orleans?
All of it. And it's just something about the way we, as performers from this city, the way we do things, we hear extra sounds in our heads, extra beats, extra backbeats, extra rhythms that people from other parts of the United States just don't understand or get.
Another man done gone. Another man done gone. Another man done gone. He had to leave his home. Another man done gone.
The phrasing, it just sounds so much like New Orleans in particular. And as a female vocalist, Irma is the epitome of that.
Another storm has come.
She is the soul queen of New Orleans. And we never say New Orleans here, but that's the only way it rhymes. She's sort of ingrained into the genetics of this place.
I never tell my left hand what my right hand is doing.
I went to visit Irma Thomas at her house in New Orleans East. She had warned me before I came, do your homework and don't ask the same stupid questions everyone else asks. Noted. Irma Thomas is 69, and she's been singing, well, just about that long.
I can't remember when I didn't sing. It was just a part of life.
And Irma Thomas's life has taken a bunch of sharp turns. She got pregnant after eighth grade, was married at 14, a mother of three by the time she was 17. She was a single mom working as a waitress at a nightclub, but she couldn't resist getting on stage to sing with a band.
Of course, I had a white boss again who had a segregated mentality. He said he didn't hire me to sing. He hired me to wait tables, even though the audience was asking for the singing waitress. That didn't mean a thing to him, so he fired me.
But the band leader told her, Irma, you sing well enough to make records. He got her an audition at a recording studio. She learned a new song, You Can Have My Husband, But Please Don't Mess With My Man, on a Monday.
And I recorded it that Wednesday, and 2 weeks later I had a record out, and the rest is history. It happened just like that.
It was 1959. She was 18. I brought that song with me, and we popped it into the CD player.
Oh, you have the original version. Very young voice.
Irma Thomas's face lit up as she listened to her own voice from more than 50 years ago. She'd listen, slowly shake her head, and smile.
To think I actually knew what I was talking about.
I'm telling all you women, I want you all to understand.
I laugh because it sounds strange, funny in a sense, because I sound so young. And I can relate to how far I've come since that time and how much I've learned musically and how to put a song across more now than then, even though I know what I was talking about then, because I've matured and there's a lot more gone. As I say, a lot of water have gone under the bridge since that time. And so you can sing it with a whole different perspective.
But the life experience, you think, comes through in the songs, comes through in the way you sing.
Yeah. I choose songs with the intention of having something that I can understand and be able to interpret from life experiences to sell the song. And in order to make it believable, you have to know what the song is about. I mean, I've sung songs where I've heard the lyrics, and if the lyrics were kind of vague, I would actually ask the writer, what were you thinking about when you wrote the song, so I can understand what I'm singing about.
What do you think happens then with your voice when you are in a song, when you're inhabiting a song that way?
Well, it depends on the situation and the time when you're singing it. I've sung songs in the studio and literally cried while doing them because something would come up, a memory or something that I can relate to where that song fit that situation. And rather than stop and go in the corner and cry, I just go down and sing the song with the tears meeting under my chin. I've done that many times.
Her love for singing translates when she's singing. You can tell this is someone, they're all about this. She brings everything to the moment.
Alan Toussaint was recording with Irma Thomas from the very start, and they've been collaborating ever since. In the early 60s, she'd come by his parents' shotgun house in New Orleans. He'd sit at the piano and compose for her right there on the spot.
I remember when I was writing It's Raining, she was sitting right there, and it began raining outside. I just wrote that song then and handed it over to her and sung a little bit of it just to show her the melody, and it fit like a gown, like an evening gown made and tailored for her.
It's raining.
It's heart-wrenching when she sings. It's dripping with soul. It really is.
Pianist David Torkanowski says when he plays with Irma Thomas, it feels like an intimate conversation.
That's why people love her, because there is no pretense to her delivery or the sound of her voice or how she renders a lyric. There's no pretense. And she won't sing anything that she doesn't believe in.
Early in the morning and I can't get right. Had a little date with my baby last night. Now it's early in the morning.
For me, what's so special about Irma Thomas is her conviction, her intent. You feel it behind every word she sings. She lives in these songs. But her intensity also comes from what she doesn't do. She doesn't get fancy or toss in a filigree of notes. She doesn't need to.
I don't think my fan base care about how many notes I can hit. They want me to sing the doggone song. And if the song doesn't dictate adding all this other stuff to it, then why do it? You know, I mean, sure, I might be able to hit 15 notes in one bar, but is it going to help the song? No.
That's Irma Thomas, one of NPR's 50 great voices, at home in New Orleans.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to NPR's Arts Podcast.